Good evening and welcome to this live stream on the 26th of May 2026. It's Martin North here from Digital Finance Analytics. Great to have you on this evening. Thanks for taking some of your Tuesday evening out to spend it with us. Really appreciate it. We're going to have a really fascinating conversation evening about all things property related. Veronica's TDAT River come in just a second. Just before I bring in, remind you, as I always do, we're not providing specific financial or property or legal advice. We moderate the chat, but feel free to throw questions, comments, suggestions, we go. If you use that Walk the World DFA, that'll get into my queue and I'll see your questions and I can bring them on stream. I've also enabled Super Chat, which means that you can make a contribution to what you do around here, or indeed get your question to the top of the list. We'll appreciate those who support us via Super Chat, PayPal, or Patreon. It really makes a difference. We don't do this for profit. We do this because we think there's a very, very important conversation to be had, particularly at the moment. Let me bring Veronica straight in. Veronica, welcome back. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good. I'm a bit warm. So, you know, it's funny how 33 degrees sounds nothing in Australian money, right? But it's fascinating to see how everybody in the UK wilts when it gets to about 25, 26, 27. And we, shock of horrors, we had an overnight temperature of only 20 degrees centigrade, which, you know, is unheard of. That's tropical in UK money.
Well, it's wet here. Yeah. So in Sydney, wet.
quite a few people have been saying that in the chat, actually. Andrew said he's been in Sydney and it's wet week. Can't wait to get back to Perth. And Bill says it's wet and miserable. So yeah. It is fascinating to see the weather differences. Now, talking about weather differences, property weather differences, right, is what I want to talk about this evening. And in fact, Veronica, you need to introduce yourself because I never know how to introduce yourself other than to say that you do a lot of things property related. We have a lot of irons in the fire. This is your website, right? Property without the BS, which is, I think, a good way to think about it. But just for those who may not know, why don't you just introduce yourself?
Oh, thank you, Martin. Well, I am a residential property expert in Australia. I've got a buyer's agency, that's Good Deed Property Buyers, but I've also got an online course for first home buyers, that's called Home Buyer Academy. I've also about to relaunch a mentoring program or training program for new buyer's agents. I've also got a property management business. So, and we do a lot of vendor advocacy as well across the whole of the country. So apart from that, I've got two podcasts, The Elephant in the Room, where we talk about all the contrarian things to do with property, really what drives the property market. And it's a great learning opportunity, not just for our listeners, but for us. And I've also got Your First Home Buyer Guide podcast. So I'm busy.
You're always busy. That's good. And what I find fascinating is that you look at this property Rubik's Cube from a lots of different perspectives, right? And I really value that at the moment because I think there's a lot of myopic coverage going on at the moment. For example, this came out, you know, property sellers have been hit by reluctant buyers, or the rate hikes and tax changes have broken the back of the latest property boom. This is from the ABC by David Taylor, literally today. I made a show, New Home Prices Are Sliding, So Who Takes the Fall? And of course, if you look at the indices, well, some of the indices are actually showing a bit of a dive at the moment. And the clearance rates, if you look at that, this is the AMP version of it. You can see that they're falling. They're talking about wary buyers send Sydney and Melbourne house prices tanking, you know, forecast to drop 9%. And the rate and taxes to take the steam out of the property market, according to the RBA. And even Morgan Stanley came out with the largest price correction expectation over the last 40 years, 10%. And of course, this just puts it in context, right? This is actually the recent falls, and you can see, whoa, it's worse than it's ever been. So, you know, doom and gloom. But the point is, and this is the whole point about this conversation, right? I think there are going to be some winners and there are going to be some losers. And it's not just a matter of sitting back and thinking, well, I've been hit over the head with a 4x2 and it's the government's fault, right? The decisions that you make as a prospective purchaser of property or a holder of property has a huge amount to do it too. And in fact, before the budget, Veronica, you actually put out a social media post, which I thought was absolutely brilliant, because you tried to make the point in that post that it does depend. It depends on lots of things. And that's what I want to get to tonight.
That is the answer to every question that I get asked, basically. It depends. And there's so much black and white thinking when it comes to property. There, for starters, all those headlines, assume there's one property market in this country. Well, there's not. There's dozens, hundreds, even, maybe even thousands. And, like the boom, well, where was booming? I mean, Adelaide, Perth, and Brisbane were booming, but Melbourne and Sydney haven't been booming for the last couple of years. So, like it's, and then Sydney and Melbourne tanking. Well, Sydney, Melbourne were already under pressure when interest rates started rising. So, of course, they're the first to get hit. You know what I mean? There's all this simple explanations for all of these things, really. Well, when I say simple, that's not simple. That's the problem. The headlines are really simple, but if you start to really look at the micro markets, you start to understand really what's going on.
Yeah, and you and I both share that same view that it is not one market, it's multiple markets, and you have to go granular, you have to understand the dynamics. Units behave differently to standalone property, Sydney behaves different to Perth, all of those different things. And so I'm a very strong opinion that all of those headlines that we went through were about clicks and clickbait rather than information and informing. And particularly now, it seems to me very, very important that people, take a chill pill, but go and really understand what is going on. And that's really what I want to try and get to today. Because, for example, I had a question come in a few days ago from somebody who's, it's Lindsay actually. She's trying to become a first-time buyer, and she saved up, and she basically thought when the government 5% deposit scheme would come in, that would be the key to unlock the property market. And then to find the interest rates went up, and suddenly the borrowing power that she had dissipated. And she said in her post to me was, well, I feel as though I'm being funneled because I want a house, but I'm being funneled by government policy into high rise in a part of the place that I don't really want to live in because that's the only choice I've got. So it seems to me that the problem we've got is that the policies that are being rained down from on a high are having a lot of implications for people on the ground. I'm not sure that some of those policymakers get it.
They don't. I mean, I hear rhetoric, political rhetoric, and it's quite obvious to me that they don't get it. For example, this budget, well, obviously we're going to get to the budget. It's meant to help first home buyers. And the reality is that there's a lot of things in that budget that, yes, they sort of help those that are already ready to buy, but they don't necessarily help those that are not yet ready to buy. So, and when I what I mean by that is that those who are already ready to buy, they all of a sudden they won't have to compete with investors in their price bracket because that is where the majority of investors do compete in the same price bracket as first home buyers. So that's very legitimate. That's very valid. And in fact, Home Buyer Academy, we've got a course for first home buyers, and one of our students was preparing to go to his to auction last Saturday, and I'm like, you are in the box seat, mate. You won't have to spend what you need. You might have had to spend before. You will have less people bidding against you. And sure enough, he got it for less than he was prepared to go to if he had to. He'd done his price research, so it actually was fair value as well. And it was markedly reduced competition. And that was actually in Melbourne, where there's all this negative press about the whole market, and yet that lower quartile has been in growth and not at huge shoot the lights out growth, but it's certainly been positive for the last 3 months. In fact, ever since October. In fact, to be quite honest, for almost 18 months, that segment of the Melbourne market has been quite buoyant. But certainly, that was impacted when the 5% deposit was expanded. The guarantee was expanded back in October, and then you've also had a lot of investors from interstate, particularly say Melbourne, sorry, Brisbane, Adelaide and Perth taking their newfound riches and wanting to invest in Melbourne, thinking, well, Melbourne's got to be next because look what happened to Perth after 10 years in the doldrums. So they had been competing with a lot of investors in that same price range, and all of a sudden there's opportunity for those first home buyers. So that's a win for first home buyer who's actually ready to buy now. But if you're not ready to buy, your opportunity to rent vest, well, that door's been slammed shut. If that was your way of getting into the market, or your ability to save, if you're somebody that wants to save in a little bit more, I guess, risky investment vehicles, maybe crypto, but but even less risky, maybe ETFs and those types of things. Well, you're going to be paying more capital gains tax now. So, there's ways that they've knocked them for six and taken away opportunities for them to get ahead that they previously had.
Yes, and that is the point because, argument goes, well, there might be less investors, although it's called grandfathered, of course, so maybe investors will just sit on the properties they've got unless it's a new build. But on the other hand, if investors are selling, then they're probably going to be selling to people who potentially could be first-time buyers. So it might be a net 1-1 swap, except the economics of those two things are completely different.
Look, when I was in third grade, I was a pretty bright kid at school, and I used to get A's from all my projects, and because I was really good at researching using the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I had a project about cows, and I thought, you know what, I don't need to look this one up because the life cycle of a cow basically means that it starts as a cow, it grows up, it has a calf, it gives lots of milk, and when it's over that, it actually gets killed for its meat, and then we can use the skin to make boots and belts. And of course, I got a C. And I think that I really look at the way my 7-year-old brain logically worked out the life cycle of a cow. And I really think that a lot of these people that are making decisions in our political class at the moment, they've got the same sort of mental capacity as my 7-year-old brain. And so when they look at every house that gets sold by an investor, gets sold to a first home buyer, well, that's not necessarily true. There's a number of facts that throw that out. One is that a lot of investors that have been selling out have been longer term investors who have actually been selling properties that are more expensive than a first home buyer can afford. And in fact, there's a lot of pressure on the sort of larger family homes in the investment market because a lot of that sort of stock is being sold out. So, not being sold to a first home buyer. The second thing is that not all first home buyers are currently renters. So it's not like just a nice little neat swap. And then the third fact is that the household composition of rented properties is larger than that of owner occupiers. So if you just look at the simple maths and go, well, if the average household size is four, for argument's sake, and that's sold to somebody where of a group where the average household size is three, then one person's displaced. So, it doesn't follow that, oh, that's okay, we can just get all the investors out of the market and the first home buyers will get in. Some people still need to rent. And the government, if they want not-for-profit rentals, needs to step up and provide not-for-profit rentals. But they have been out of that business for decades.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I have a view, and we'll get onto the budget in more detail in a second, that actually, if you look at what's happened now, the tax breaks for build to rent corporates, right? They get 15%, right? Now, effectively, if you're a mum and dad investor and your worst case, you could be at 47%, right? So actually, they may be tilting the field away from the mum and dad investor and perhaps towards the corporate investor. And of course, Andrew Bragg went a stage further and said, well, maybe actually, if you think about it, well, the Labour is actually design, a system that super funds can become corporate landlords by pushing individual Australians out. Now, those are some of the sort of the interesting issues that you see. Once you start peeling this away, it's tilting the playing field. And having spent 30 years or more, when the government is saying, well, if you want to actually be an investor, we welcome it. And mum and dad investors, you need a property or two, and we'll give you some tax breaks, et cetera. And suddenly they've sort of shifted the dials. I'm of the view that, yes, the negative gearing and capital gains thing definitely gave a kick up to prices of property, as did the reduction in the lending standards, as did the deregulation of the financial system, as did securitization, as did all the first-time owner grants, as did.
Yep.
The point is,
More
CGT,
than one thing.
yeah, it's exactly right. It's a multifactorial issue. Now, most of those factors actually were created by political intent. And what they said they were doing and what they were actually doing probably wasn't necessarily, a zero-sum game. I think there's some significant overlaps between the two. And look, I've had this view for quite some time that actually, if you think about it, and in fact, David Pocock at the weekend on the ABC made the point, it's not necessarily left versus right, it's actually vested interests and their stranglehold on the major parties versus the Australian people. I think that's a very, very good point to make, right? There's more going on here than, oh, we'll make it a bit easier for you to get into the market.
Yeah, and in fact, it's public knowledge, or it's easy to get the information about how many people are utilising negative gearing, how many people, you know, what the government's giving you away in terms of capital gains tax discount. It's not so easy to find out information about how much of the quantum of the tax breaks has been offered to the builder rent sector. And that's not going to solve the rental crisis anyway, because that is a typically higher value or a higher priced rental property. I mean, we've still got the problem with affordable rental and really making renting affordable. So that has been, in my view, unaddressed by this budget.
Absolutely. And in fact, there was an article I saw recently that suggested if you look at some of those build to rent programs that are meant to have a certain proportion of those properties effectively affordable, well, they're defining affordable based on market numbers.
Yes.
Not rental income. So they're still not affordable for the people who need them. And by the way, a lot of those build to rent programs have under delivered on those affordable numbers as well. So this has failed on so many fronts to address the fundamental structural issue that we have in Australia, which sort of quite nicely then segues into, okay, we had the budget, and you know, the budget was a surprise to some, not least because it was a broken promise based on what Albo had said previously, right? And now he's basically visibly, emotionally defending Labor's capital gains tax and negative gearing changes and launched an impassioned argument in favour of the reforms. Now, those reforms, of course, cover more than property. They cover other types of capital assets too. And so there's been quite a vociferous response on things like family trusts and other issues there. But with regard to the property-specific issues, well, where does it leave us?
Well, it'll be interesting. For starters, it's not legislated yet. And it'll be very interesting to see how all those negotiations go through with the various, you know, independents, crossbench, the other parties, to see what, I mean, they're apparently presenting legislation, you know, in tranches. So I don't know.
Yeah, Thursday's going to have some of it, but not necessarily all of it. Yeah.
Exactly. So we're going to have to wait and see. And so a lot of people, a lot of buyer's agents, a lot of property spruikers, a lot of property advisors, they've been all over social media with their new strategies. So throw out the old strategy because, of course, investors, not many are going to be able to buy or afford to buy existing property. And so therefore, oh, well, how can we still get money out of people who want to invest in property? And so all of a sudden there's these new strategies, a proliferation of them. And of course, SMSFs have been left untouched. So all of a sudden there'll be a lot more, how much money have you got in your super? Oh, you can still buy a property in your super. I mean, the family trust thing is still going on. I see buyer's agents on TikTok, and when, actually I don't watch TikTok, so I should say Instagram Reels and Facebook Reels. But I see these reels with buyer's agents encouraging people to set up family trusts. And so, and I'm like, don't you realize that that is actually giving financial advice? You're actually breaking the law, you know, but they don't seem to care. They're going to go into these high yield investments, you know, cooperatives and various, more the granny flat strategy will be back. You know, they're going to go into units in regional towns and they'll pump those prices up. They won't be able to hang around for long though, because the yields will get too low. But so there's all these sort of pivoting and moving around. How can I get your money? How can you still invest in property? Because it's the best way to, you know, make your wealth, make your fortune. So sadly, that's sadly typical, sadly unsurprising, I guess. and then you've got really sensible people should be sitting tight and waiting. You've got this rhetoric about all these investors are going to suddenly sell. Why, if you have a negative cash flow property and you currently have the right to negative gear that against your income, why would you sell it? Like, why would you? So, I mean, there's just a lot of ridiculous narrative out there at the moment, to be quite honest. But sadly, I think it's, you know, I try not to be too political, but I think it's a ridiculous budget.
Yes, I have to agree. And of course, it's a cash grab, really, isn't it? If you look at it carefully and look at the amount of extra money they're going to spend, they're banking, of course, prospective savings on the NDIS, which may or may not come through. And net of it, we end up with a bigger government. Now, I have a view that there are things that government should be doing, but there are also things that government should not be doing. And just becoming more and more of the total economy is a problem, not least because, of course, the lack of productivity, particularly amongst the government sector, but also it completely drowns out private sector. And of course, if you look, for example, at construction at the moment, one of the reasons why construction in housing is a problem is because all the tradies are building public sector stuff because there's a lot of public sector projects going as well. So it crowds out the normal market. And so that's another factor in all of this. And I'm not sure that bigger government is the right answer to anything.
No, and I have never particularly subscribed to the idea that Labor are not good money managers, but I have to say this is starting to have me rethink any defences that I've had of Labor. It fails to understand human behaviour, and so this is the thing too, that I was really surprised that they don't even leave it available for one capital gains, negative gearing available for one property, right? If they did that, they would have reduced the amount of competition against first home buyers because there are investors that are buying multiple properties and there's a lot of buyers agents pumping that market as well, right? So if you took that out, that sort of kills that side of things. But you've also got the ability, because people still want to aspire. You know, I don't think you should take away the ability for Australians to aspire once you have actually bought a home and you've acquired some equity there, to the opportunity to buy at least just one investment property. Great. But you know what gets me, and also the rent vestors that I mentioned, the 6,500 roughly last year, that won't have the opportunity this year, right? But what really gets me is that this negative gearing thing, if you already own property and you're already positive cash flow because you're getting an income from that property, you can continue to negatively gear on a new property that you buy, like as in not a brand new property, on an established property that you buy. So talk about wedging the divide between those that have and those who do not have. You know, they have an unfair advantage to continue to grow their portfolio, and first home buyer who might want to get their first property being a rent investor cannot do it. So I think that that's a real issue.
Absolutely, it is. And of course, we should also just reflect on the rental sector in all of this too. In fact, Jason asked the question a little while ago. The government is saying it will increase rents by 2% per week.
$2.
$2, I should say. Yes, thank
$2.
you. Yeah, $2. Who as an investor would implement a $2 a week increase? Yeah, right. And interestingly, two things. My latest stress surveys, I run them at the end of each month, shows a further uptick in rental stress. So a lot more people, around 74 and a bit percent of those in the rental sector, have cash flow pressures. But the other interesting thing is that the number of people who have had significant rental increases before the budget, actually, and some of those were attributed to the interest rate rises that the RBA executed. So to my mind, this is going to put more upward pressure on the rental sector at a time when rents are, well, unaffordable for a lot of people.
So, look, it will, because some people will still, as I said, an owner, sorry, an investor who has negative gearing benefits on a good asset is going to be very unlikely to want to sell that good asset, because that's the negative gear, or the opportunity to negatively gear, is an asset effectively. And once it's gone, it's gone. So that's not going to lead to this, you know, shock selling up of investment properties. But there will be people who have owned a property long enough to not need negative gearing anymore, positive cash flow, and they'll be looking at the decline or the reduction in capital gains tax discount, and they may well decide to sell. And so what you are going to be finding is in established areas where there's not a lot of new housing being built, not a lot of new development, not a lot of sites and the availability to construct, you are going to see rents rising in those areas, in those markets, because they will have less stock available. Now, we're already dealing with very low vacancy rates, That's the real reason rents are rising. It's not because interest rates are going up. Let me tell you, if every time my costs go up as a landlord, I could just jack the rent up, great, I'd do that. But there's been times during the time, the years that I've been a landlord, I've had to drop the rents because the market has not borne the previous rent that I've got for properties for various reasons. So landlords can only charge what the market will bear. Now, I think also when you've got a reduced amount of rental property available, and as I mentioned earlier, quite a lot of the bigger homes have been sold. And so the people who would previously have rented those bigger homes, they've got bigger budgets, and they will price out people who have got lesser budgets, and they're going to have to take up the rental stock that is available. So they might not get as good a home as they might have been able to get before, but they're going to be able to outbid somebody else at a lesser price bracket. So all these things put pressure on rental markets. Now, obviously, like the selling market, like the property prices, there's different markets across the whole country. So, the regional markets might have actually, and I don't have any data on this. You've probably got data on this, Martin, but there's potentially regional centres where rents have gone down because of the influx of investors buying up stock in those areas. So you got more rental stock than you would think that there'd be pressure to put rents down. I don't know whether that has happened or not. Be interesting to check that. But this is the thing, that the supply and demand of rental accommodation is really what's behind whether or not you can put rents up.
Absolutely. And of course, the immigration's question, as Bill made the point, immigration number is a key issue too, right? Because when people come into the country, predominantly they will go into the rental sector first, and they'll probably funnel through some of the main, the Melbourne and Sydney as a way in, and then sort of spread out. Yeah, my data suggests that there are places where rents have gone down. Unfortunately, some of the places where rents have gone down are not people where people would really aspire to live, which is part of the problem, right? So sometimes where you want to live, rents are going up. Where you choose not to live but may have to live, you may have to live somewhere you don't want to live, but you can do it for cheaper. And that's really the problem, that effectively, because of this, again, this multi-headed monster that we're talking about, there are so many factors in here all sort of pushing in different directions, that it's quite difficult to get the outcome that you want. But the interesting question for me, Veronica, is Labour, before they came into power for the second time, Claire O'Neill said, "We want to see sustainable house price rises," right? Sustainable house price rises, but no, implicitly saying we don't want them to fall, right? Now, when you've actually got property prices that are 40% over long-term trend, and when you've got affordability through the floor, promising that prices will continue to rise seems to me a little bit naive at best. But if you're in the market and you hold property, well, that's what you want, of course. And as the ex-ANZ economist used to say, and still I think does say, actually, if you're in the market and you've got property, you're going to be a greater proportion of the population than the first-time buyers, who are a relatively small proportion. So maybe it's not surprising that we actually have policies that actually support those who are already in the market rather than those who aspire to get into the market despite everything they say.
Well, they're walking a tightrope, aren't they? Let's face it, you've got 10 million property owners in this country who vote. So I'm not going to say to 10 million voters, well, guess what? Let's just kill your property values. And you got last year there was 120,000 first home buyers. That's a big difference, right? And so even in this budget, they're not saying that prices are going to fall. What they're saying is that price growth will slow down, right? So again, that's not necessarily opening up the door for first home buyers to waltz right in. But what they are doing, the 5% deposit guarantee, that certainly helps first home buyers get into the market, right? As long as you've got the income, of course. But so does a shared equity scheme. And I was watching a movie on SBS the other week, and I was sorting ads for both coming up every single ad break. So that's how you make housing more affordable. You actually take a share, don't you, government? So you can't actually build houses, but you can actually own a share of a first home buyer's house. It's just insane.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the first buyer grant thing with the 5%, negative equity is potentially now a risk, right? Because prices are actually in some cases easing back. And they did show, I think, post the October announcement, that prices moved higher in the range of properties that were supported by the first-time buyer scheme versus those that weren't. But it was a relatively short-term thing because it pulled people forward rather than expanding the aperture of people who could actually get into the market. And the shared equity scheme is a bit of a nutty scheme in a way because, as you say, it means the government's got a share in the property. So if it goes up, well, they get a share of the equity, presumably. Other thought is, if there's a negative equity issue, the government has a liability potentially. The old lenders, mortgage insurers used to do that. Now the it's on the government's shingle now.
Well, that's what I was wondering actually about that, because, you know, like if they're all racing out to maximise every incentive they can get and shared equity, and I'm not sure, I haven't actually looked into it enough to know whether it's even possible, but if they rush out and buy a brand new house and land package, for argument's sake, like who is protecting our taxpaying interests in terms of what assets the government is going into partnership on? Like that's something that is real issue.
It's an unlimited scheme, right? It has no limit.
So, I mean, that again, that is like my seven-year-old project on how a cow, you know, really the life cycle of a cow. That is not understanding property, not understanding that not all property goes up in value, not understanding risk. That is mind-bogglingly naive, in my view.
It is, absolutely, and it's highly simplistic and highly worrying because either they genuinely believe these strategies are going to make the difference that they want, which means they're naive, or they're being absolutely cynical about it and are doing it just for political posturing purposes to show that they are doing things. And I've spoken before, I think, with you about this idea of announceables, right? They want to be seen to be doing things. So they want us to be able, outside a new property that somebody's just got and they picture of a key and the politician, oh, aren't we great? But it's not actually getting to the root cause issues that you know and I know have been around for a long, long time. And a lot of people are caught in this crossfire, caught in the headlights, if you like, all these things that are going on at the moment, which sort of takes me then to the question, and going back to the question that we had, right? I'm being funneled into high-rise because that's all I can afford because of what the government is doing. Doesn't sound to me like the right answer to be able to actually take housing into a sustainable future where people can afford to hold property and live in property. And I've had the view for some time that property is actually ultimately a human right. It isn't just, you know, for the rich. It should be something which pretty much everybody can get access to because it's, well, you need it because you need somewhere to live.
It is a human right. 100% it is a human right. Now, where we get a bit blurry on this is that there's a lot of organisations that seem, or left-leaning organisations that seem to think that it's a good thing that property prices have gone backwards in places like Melbourne apartments, right? They think that that's a successful strategy because that allows more people to get in and to the property market. And I understand that logic, except the minute you're in and you've got an asset that's either staying the same price or going backwards, you are actually stuck. You're handcuffed. Mortgage prisoner, right? And if you get a divorce, if you have triplets instead of one kid, if you get a promotion and you need to move into whatever it is, any life change that isn't necessarily anticipated, and then you're forced to sell a property that at best case is worth what you paid for it, and so you lose all the costs, or worst case is worth less. And the Melbourne apartment, inner Melbourne apartment market is still has a really high proportion of properties selling at first time resale at a loss. So this has been the situation for a good 10 years now, or more even. That is actually not a good outcome. And I would say to people, they're better off renting. They're better off going to one of those overpriced rent vesting, I mean, the overpriced build to rent buildings, and pay a premium and have the freedom to not get trapped into a property that they might regret buying. Now, that is a very real risk, and it is not talked about enough, and it's sort of glorified as this idea about getting into the market. That is not a good outcome.
No, absolutely. Now, you mentioned rent vesting, And of course, there was a period of time when rent vesting seemed to be an interesting strategy for first-time buyers who couldn't afford to get into the market where they wanted to. So the idea was that they go somewhere else, at least put a toe in the market, hopefully enjoy some of the benefits of that, and then use that later to effectively get their own property. What's your thoughts on how this changes the rent vesting story?
Well, it pretty much locks first home buyers out of this as an option, because first home buyers need to be able to offset the cost against their income and the tax, get a tax rebate for a tax offset for that, in order to be able to afford to buy a property. And so they're utilizing that negative gearing. You know, it reminds me of going back to when Bill Shorten was trying to get elected in the unlosable election back in 2019, where they took that and other various things to the electorate, and they didn't get voted in. And he was often up there going, why should someone get to buy their sixth property? You know, and first home buyers miss out. And I'm like, mate, dude, there's 2-3% of people have got, you know, five or more properties in their portfolio. It's a tiny percentage. So just stop focusing on this tiny percentage, and 72% only have one investment property. But the other statistic that got distorted, and it really used to annoy me, I was trying to find the source of this the other day actually, was that, you know, that they often come out and say 80% of the tax refunds go to the top earners. And you go, well, of course, because they pay 47 cents in the dollar tax. So it stands to reason that they're going to get a bigger refund. But what they never said was that 80% of the people that utilize negative gearing fell in the lower income brackets. That's 80% of the human beings using it, not 80% of the dollars being paid back. And I think that that is something that has been missing from all of this debate. And they are the people that really are missing out from not being able to utilize negative gearing on their first property.
Absolutely. And again, I think it shows that the policies that were sprayed around weren't necessarily that well understood or thought through by the people who sprayed them around, right? Mm. But again, it sounds good in theory until you actually start looking at it, right? And my sense is similar to yours, that this is going to significantly change the game for those people trying potentially to get into the market. The other side of it, of course, is that the budget will favour owner-occupied property, your own property, because that is a tax-free shelter now. And so potentially you're going to see perhaps more demand for those types of property and, perhaps expanding and extending and adding more floors and things as a way of building wealth that way.
Yeah, that's exactly what people will be doing. I mean, Chris Bates, my co-host on The Elephant in the Room, he's a mortgage broker, and he's been saying this, already seen an appetite for people coming to him saying, well, that's obviously where we need to invest in our own home. I've spoken to some of my clients who are thinking that exact same way. So, yes, I think that is definitely a logical thing. And again, it tax drives behavior, right? Tax, you know, it's like that's how people respond. They still want to invest in property. That's how they're going to do it, right?
Yeah, so people are Bitcoin operated, right? And that, you know, if the rules change, they play the coins differently, which is it's natural. And what I find interesting here is that the sophistication that you need to be able to understand some of these implications has not really been coming through in any of those articles that we mentioned earlier on. It's all sort of a big spray, a big sort of splurge of noise. But it does depend on where you are in your property journey, you know, whether you're somebody aspiring to get into property, whether you're holding a property currently, whether you're thinking of upsizing or downsizing. I think some downsizers will have an interesting challenge now, because if prices do slide back, that could actually change some of the rules for them as well. And then if you are actually looking to own a property versus invest in a property, again, the rules are now changing once again. So pretty much every element is actually in flux at the moment. And I guess one of the questions I've got is, if you go and talk to a mortgage broker about getting a mortgage, you're missing a whole bunch of those strategic questions that we've just touched on, which they won't want to touch.
It is very difficult to get good advice on property. And I guess I'm a little biased, because I do think I give good advice on property, but I don't tell people what to do. I ask a lot of questions. Because there's a lot of people out there giving advice that they're pushing their solution, whatever they're selling, and the market is full of that. And even when it comes to talking to your mortgage broker, there's some fantastic brokers out there that are really strategic about borrowing strategy and all the rest of it, but they're selling money. That's what they sell, right? So most of them know nothing about property. Some do, but they are an absolute minority. And they get asked the questions because they're a free service, right? And a lot of buyers asking questions they really shouldn't ask them. And they were happy to answer it, even though they're way out of their lane, because property advice is not regulated.
Yeah, just pause on that thought and just reiterate again, folks, this is really important to understand. Property advice is not regulated, which means that anybody can pretty much say anything they want. They can write anything that they want. They can put stuff on social media and play it any way they want, and nobody cares.
And they do
Yeah,
so much
consistently.
rubbish. Yeah, shocking.
Yeah.
And the people that follow some of this advice or this best practice or strategies or whatever they want to call it, they're not going to know. They're the ones stuck holding the can, and they're not going to know whether or not that was good advice for years.
No, and that's the other point. I've talked before, I think, about the punctiliar action. So it's a point in time, but it has a consequence, right? That decision that you take about what property you buy or don't buy has a profound impact, not just at a point in time, but subsequent too. Now, if you're in a situation where you believe that prices double every 7 to 10 years and will always do that. And I still hear a lot of people say that, despite the fact that actually I can produce lots of data to show you that in some places, North Ryde apartments being one of them, that's not true. But if you actually start with that sort of religious fervor about property, you're going to make bad decisions, right? And trying to strip the fervor from the reality and trying to actually get grounded seems to me the most critical thing for anybody who's thinking about anything to do with any property transaction, whether it's buying or selling or renting or owning. Now, how do you get grounded, Veronica? How do you get grounded?
Oh, I've got another book in me, I think, at some point on this. Our human frailties get in the way. We've got so many biases that we operate out of when it comes to property, that so many people make crazy decisions. How do you get grounded? I guess it's one reason why Megan Wells and I put together the course of first home buyers, which we've had people that are not first home buyers do that course, actually, because it just teaches the process and teaches how to think through making these decisions. Because I said earlier, the answers to most questions is depends, but there are a lot of real principles to understand. And one is that new sector, the house and land packages and the off the plan or the high-rise apartments, there is so much overwhelming data to prove that they tend to lose value, not only not keep up with houses, but lose value. And it's overwhelming, the evidence. It overwhelming. And yet first home buyers are funneled in, and now investors are going to be funneled in. So the first home buyers have been funneled in will actually be competing with investors. So that probably pushed the prices up in that sector. Go figure. I know a lot of people. I personally know people in Melbourne. You've probably interviewed people who have bought a off the plan apartment in Melbourne, and maybe not, that's the worst place, but there's plenty of places in Sydney. And 10 years later, it's still worth less than what they paid for it. That is not a success story. That does not help anybody's, housing is a right story. That's housing is a trap. And so that's the first thing, is to recognize that not all property goes up in value. This 7 to 10 years doubling, it's nice. And I tell you, in my buyer's agency business, we do actually look for characteristics of properties that have the potential to do that. We're very selective, and it's all about asset selection, understanding markets, right? But I don't buy all across Australia. I'm not an expert all across Australia. When it comes to buying property, we have a very finite area. So there's a lot of buyer's agents out there that buy borderless. They'll buy anywhere. Well, don't use one of them. They don't know enough about local markets to make sure that you're choosing a good asset. And what they often don't even understand is that even in the same market, you will have a wide variety of performance at different properties, different types of properties. And then within one city, different suburbs will perform in a wide variety of ways. And you've got to understand that even if there's median price data that indicates one suburb's going up and another suburb's going down, it doesn't necessarily mean that individual properties within those suburbs are performing along the same index. So there's a lot of nuance. And I think you just have to slow down and recognize that there's all of these myths are myths and become an expert in the area in which you're wanting to buy. You've got to take the time to work out what it is you need to look for, what other buyers are looking for in that area, but also to understand prices. There's just so much to understand, but it's a big, big, big decision, and people shortcut it, and they really need to take the time to slow down and learn the process.
Well, I think I've probably shared this thought before with you, but I'll say it again. It amazes me that people spend more time researching the price of a new refrigerator and going online and comparing all the reviews and all of those things, and and trying to actually really understand. I can save $10 here if I go this route versus that route, and this one might last 5 years, and that one might last 10 years. Compared with the research they do on a property. And so often in my one-to-one conversations, and I've had quite a few recently, they feel completely helpless insofar that, one, there's huge pressure coming from the agents to make a decision, make a decision, make a decision, right? Act now. You've got to act now because you're going to miss out here, right? Second, that they are relying on the agent for quite a lot of information about what the property is worth, because getting hold of good price information is getting harder and harder and harder, not least because of the privatization of the registries. And that's a real problem, trying to understand the market.
It's the analysis of that price data. I mean, we have a little course that people can buy, learn how to price a property like a professional, right? And that is because you can access the information. It's how do you then compare it to the property that you're looking at? And there is a process. And a lot of people also, when they're making up their minds about whether they can afford a property in an area or not, they look in completely the wrong section of the portals. Like they're looking at what is on the market, not what has sold. And they don't spend the time to learn market values in that way. And they don't also work out how to properly compare a property either. And so unless you're in a really homogenous area where all the houses are the same, there's a lot of variation between properties that have sold. So you've got to know how to assess them in relative to the property that you're looking at buying. And if you're looking at buying in an area where all the properties are the same, I'd hazard that maybe that's not a great area to be buying a property in, because scarcity is a very important concept in property.
Yes, scarcity and the real features that a particular property has is one of those essentials to understand. And even things like which side of the street and those sorts of things are actually quite important when it comes to that. And the street itself relative to the street next door, for example, as well. And all of those things come into it. And again, my one-to-one conversations, I so often find that people have done very little beyond just going on to the what's for sale now and assume that that actually tells you the full story. Well, it doesn't, And in New South Wales, we are lucky. We still have the publicly available information from the registry, which is quite useful. In some other states, it doesn't exist in that same format. So you have to actually go about the houses and use the other property portals. And in some cases, you have to pay for the data. So it can be a mess. But the point is that this is a decision that is going to be a complex decision. It's a decision you need to take your time, and you need to get the ducks in a row with all the information. And so, your process is absolutely critical to understand. It's a journey. It's a set of decision steps you take. What you don't do is to say, "Ah, oh, there's a property. Oh, I love it. I'm going to buy it," and then try and retrofit everything else around it. That's completely the wrong way to go. And yet, unfortunately, this emotional attachment that we've got to property and the emotional reaction we sometimes get to a place can get in the way.
Yeah, but it's not just the property. It's like, you're looking around, you're going through an open house, and there's lots of other people looking interested. Well, that's social proof. That's another behavioral bias, right? The anchoring bias, when you fail to do your own price research and work out what it's really worth, you hinge your impression of the price on what the agent is quoting. Now, there's some degree of relativity, but I've tracked individual agents and their quote price versus sale price, and there's not, I mean, there's some patterns, but there's no set, oh, well, this agent always underquotes by 14% and this one underquotes by 18%. It actually isn't that simple. And so anyone that comes along and just whacks on a flat percentage or flat dollar value on top of whatever an agent is quoting, well, they're going to be out, right? They're going to either underpay all the time and then under offer and they're never going to buy anything, or they're going to overpay by the first property that they find. And there will be times when an agent accidentally overquotes a property, and so if you just add onto that one, well, you're definitely overpaying. So there's a lot of nuance that people need to understand, and it's different state by state as well, because of course different states have different buying processes because they've got different property legislation and there's different vendor disclosures. And so the information that is given to you, mandatory information that is given to you, is different in every state and territory. And then you've got to know what that information contains, what else you need to find out before you buy a property. There's a lot to know so you don't get stuck.
Absolutely. And getting stuck is definitely an issue for some people. Again, in my one-to-one conversations, unfortunately, I quite often have had people who come to me having got stuck. You know, I've got this apartment that is yielding negative cash flow. It's gone down in value rather than up in value. I've held it for 5 years. Do I keep holding up? Do I not? Well, I don't give them an answer, but I show them the numbers and suggest that sometimes coming to terms with a decision that was a bad decision is important to be able to make a better decision next time, right? Rather than just repeating. And somebody actually said to me in one recent one-to-one, because they had this apartment that was not doing very, wasn't doing well at all, but the one next door came on the market, and they were thinking, well, maybe I should buy the one next door too, because, well, that might be giving me a bit more extra leverage. I'm thinking, why? You know, just
What?
think it through.
That's a good example of the insanity that some people have around property. It's like, I do strategy sessions. People book a strategy session with me. We go through the situation, and my goal in these sessions is to really to give them the next three things they need to answer before they can really move forward, and sort of give them some options and pull and tease out the conversation. And I really do sadly get a lot of people come to me that have got sometimes multiple properties that are what I would call C grade lemons. And sometimes they've got multiple apartments that are all worth less than what they paid. I mean, the worst scenario really, I think, was a couple that had bought three through this spruiker, and the spruiker was introduced to them by a mum in the school ground. The mums were talking, and that she went, oh, because it was like, we want to buy a home, we can't afford it. So they decided to rent vest, and oh, you should talk to my guy. He really looked after us. Well, he really stitched them up. He's helped them buy two really crap apartments in Sydney, like absolute crap. And then the third one, they're still where they were basically about to settle on it. And I'm like, you have to do everything you can to try to get out of that. See if the developer can sell it to somebody else. See if, it's an agent that will on-sell it. Just do what you can. And because, of course, it's worth I would say that particular property about 30% over market value. That's what they paid. Sorry, around about, that's huge. And then they became into an inheritance, and all of a sudden buying a home was an option, but completely like blocked because of these three terrible apartments that they've bought, all in good faith, all off the back of a maybe well-meaning, or maybe the woman actually got a kickback, I don't know, but you know what I mean, an innocent, seemingly innocent chat in the school ground, and off they've gone. And it's like, wow. And so because they made all these decisions before they realized the first one was a bad one, they're already stitched up on the third one, and then they start dawning on them, oh my God, what have we done? You're trapped.
And that trap.
And they don't want to sell.
No.
They could sell, and they don't want to sell because they don't want to realize the losses. And yet every single day it's losing them more money.
And I want to just come back because you talk about, the psychological and behavioral issues. nobody wants to sell at a loss.
Mm-mm.
But actually, sometimes that is actually the right answer. Get out, because you're just sinking further by not getting out.
Well, I look at things like, well, how many more apartment blocks are due to be built in that area? You know, what's the coming supply? How does that particular apartment stack up compared to everything else that's currently on the market for sale? You know, and like, has it got any merits? Is it any better than any of the other ones? And how long are they on the market for? What's the days on market on these things? You know, like, that tells me that this is not going to ease up anytime soon. When you've got lots of stock there, it's like, this is about cutting your losses and trying to beat all of those other people because they won't want to meet the market. It's like, you've got to make yours the most attractive. Don't wait in line. If there's 10 other properties on the market, don't wait in line after, you know, be number 11. Be really aggressive in your pricing. Get the hell out of there if you can. You know, like, when you can see that there is just no light at the end of that tunnel, we have no idea when they'll actually start to see some gains. And then, actually isn't a great asset. Like, one of those apartments, for example, is in a highly built up area. It's a one bedroom with no parking. I couldn't find any other one bedders with no parking even available. Like, you just think, why would you buy one without parking? Like, everything else has got parking. So automatically you're even less attractive. You're competing with those other one bedders and you've got one glaring, you know, thing that is lacking from your offering.
Yeah, and talking about that, this article is quite relevant, right? The Grattan Institute's come out with a research paper suggesting that we should actually not have parking spaces in price in properties, right? Up to 140,000 new homes would be built in Sydney and Melbourne if rules on residential car parking were overhauled, according to research that shows the cost of building a unit is being pushed up by tens of thousands of dollars spent on spots that may never be used. Now, talk about short-sighted. That, to me, is another classic example of, yeah, economically, yeah, you can save some money, but think about the lifestyle. Think about the people who are actually going to be living in these places, and then ask the question, does it really make sense? It's exactly in the same class as reduce the size of the unit, reduce the amount of light that you have to coming in. I mean, what are you doing? You're creating a prison.
It's the life cycle of a cow. That logic, you know, it's like, but people still drive, you know, and okay, so what are the people who drive? They can't live there because there's nowhere to park their car. Like, so talk about taking out an entire massive segment of the market, you know. Yeah, sure, there's some areas in Sydney, like in all of our inner cities, I guess, where there's no parking, but there's highly walkable and amenities, and there's only small amount of suburbs that are like that. The rest have pretty much got parking.
Absolutely. Well, we're sort of moving towards the end of the show, but I think it's just sort of worth just stepping back and just thinking. So, to me, the three messages I want to underscore with people are, one, don't get caught up in all of this media flurry that's going on at the moment. It's all too high level to be anything that's useful, right? You've really got to actually step back. Two, you always have time. Don't get bounced into making huge instant decisions. Remember that some of these changes aren't coming in for 1 year or 2 years. 2028 is the year for some of the legislation that's coming in. So there is some time. And three, this journey of following the breadcrumbs, if you're actually thinking of property transactions, it's important to follow those breadcrumbs and go step by step by step by step by step, rather than jumping to the end state and then saying, well, whoops, made a mistake. Now, to me, those are the simple thoughts that can save you from being a loser and more likely to be a winner. But what would you add to that?
You know, a little insight as to the follow the breadcrumbs. In our first home buyer course, there's 10 steps, right? And step five is revise and correct. So there's you know, step one is assembling your team of advisors. That includes your mortgage broker. The step two is really getting sort of the money part of that all right. And step three is planning, you know, where to buy. Like, there's a process that we teach in how to work out what to buy and where to buy. And so you get that planning part ready. Then step four is to get out there and start looking at property, start inspecting, start pounding the pavement. And then step five, revise and correct, is so important because that is around now that I've planned, I've got the theory, I've gone out there and looked in practice. Is my plan aligned with what the market's going to deliver? And do I still feel good about that plan? Does it really suit what I was thinking about in the first place? It's such an important part of the process to stop and check whether or not you're on the right path. And so that's, I mean, there's five other steps after that are very, very important steps in buying a property. But I really, it goes to you slowing down. It's going to making sure you're in the right. We use the analogy of, climbing a mountain, and that could mean you're straight off the path and you're about to fall down a ravine, So it's like pick your way back into the safe path. So I've never climbed a mountain, so but you can get the idea. But it is very important. Now, often in markets, there's a lot of pressure to act when the markets are rising. Well, now there's going to be a lot of pressure not to act. And so, not acting is also not necessarily a good idea if there's opportunity for you. And again, it comes back down to there's a process. You can act and do things in the right order, making sure that you're preparing and planning, but also making sure you're stopping and revising before you get to the point of. No man, no turn around, no turning back. Okay. And so I guess that's what I'd add to what you're saying there, Martin.
Very, very helpful, I think. And I think there'll be a lot of people who will really benefit from just following through on that thought and, being methodical and taking the steps just a little bit more carefully. Because I've always believed that property has significant opportunity and potential, not only for somewhere to live, but potentially as as an asset that can actually perform well. But not all property is an asset that performs well. And in the current environment, where we can probably expect to see some prices sliding, I don't know how much, Morgan Stanley says 10%, Louis Christopher says 9% in Sydney, but I don't know. Well, we'll see. Who knows? I can tell you that there are already areas in Sydney where prices have fallen, but I can also say there are other areas in Sydney where prices have gone up. That is also true even in places like Perth. So, it's not like that the whole of the market is going boom or crash, right? It's much, much more sophisticated, and so you need a more sophisticated and more complex way of thinking. And hopefully what we've done today, Veronica, is once again underscore that this is actually something which individuals and households can get their arms around and take some, accountability and responsibility for their own decisions, rather than saying, oh, it's the RBA's fault, so or it's the government's fault, right? Now, the government and the RBA will continue to meddle in the property market forever. That's what they do. But you've got to overlay this other conversation, this more methodical, structural way of thinking. And if you actually do that, whatever's happening out there is still potentially some opportunity, and it's about using those tools and techniques to be able to find them.
It's about doing the work. This is a big decision for people, any property decision, whether you're buying or selling. I use the sort of analogy, it's like going to watch a football game at a stadium and you go through the turnstile, right? Once you're through that turnstile, you can see where you came from, but you can't easily get back there, And that is what buying and selling property is like. It's a big transaction with big consequences and hard to undo. So, some people sell. They panic and sell, and then they can't get back into a market. Other people panic and buy, and they really shouldn't have done that. There's a lot to be said for learning the process, and obviously that's why Megan, it's a bit of a passion project for us that we put this course together. I'll freely admit it's not been the most lucrative thing we've ever done, but it's really so valuable for everyone who's done it and really got the confidence in doing it properly. It is a passion project for us because we can see that it does help people who want to put the effort in and get it right and do it right. And it's very rewarding as a result of that.
Absolutely. Well, I've put some links and things below so people can follow you
Oh,
via
thank
that
you.
link and then follow through to the various platforms that you have. And I do think those courses, and I also would underscore the Elephant in the Room podcast that you do with Chris, brilliant. Always got some insightful and different angles on the situation there, because this is a complex thing we're talking about. And I think that's the final thought for me, is that this is complex. It's going to continue to be complex. And don't get caught up in the flash of the moment There's another route, and hopefully we've explored some of that today. Veronica, I want to say thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation. Appreciate your insights as always. And hopefully we'll do it again sometime soon. I'm sure there'll be more to talk about because, well, property, it's always going to morph, isn't it?
The gift that keeps on giving. Thank you. It's just lucky I'm interested in my work.
Well, that's exactly right. Well, I think if you didn't, it wouldn't be a passion project and that would be a whole different story, right?
Very much. Thank you, Martin. I really appreciate the chat. It's been fun.
Lovely. I'll take you offline and I'm going to close the show. Take care. Cheers. So I hope you enjoyed that very, very important conversation and very, very significant, I think, in terms of now more than ever. Just to say that next week, Damien Klassen will be on and we're going to be talking about the financial markets and what's going on there. A lot to talk about there, Straits of Hormuz and other things too, bond rates, bond yields and all those things. So check that out. The dogs are sort of around. They've sort of expanded because they got a bit warm. So it's got a bit warm in here now. So I can zoom out. There you go. Just about see them. So they're there. I think it's time for a bit of a walk before it gets too hot. So thank you very much for taking time with me today. Really appreciate it. Have a good evening and check out the recorded shows each other week and check out the next live show next Tuesday. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off. Take care.